Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
In today's episode, we speak with Aman Chandra, a vitreoretinal surgeon who works at the Southend NHS Foundation Trust. We spoke prior to the most recent lockdown restrictions about the impact on vitreoretinal surgery from the beginning of the pandemic last year, considerations for the use of personal and protective equipment in ophthalmic surgery, and potential changes to future practice. Hi Aman, thanks for joining me today. To start with, could you just share with the listeners your experience of performing VR surgery at the beginning of the pandemic? You know, how has that changed to now, as we're about to enter 2021?
Thanks, Sunil, for this interview. So at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of unknowns and a lot of anxiety. We knew that within ophthalmology, the most common ophthalmic surgery that was going to happen during the pandemic was going to be vitreoretinal surgery for retinal detachments and such like. And so there was a lot of anxiety amongst vitreoretinal surgeons as to protection, our protection from this virus. And therefore, we, as part of Beavers and the Royal College, we drew up some guidelines to discuss and to give surgeons the necessary protection they might feel they need. So we wrote these guidelines in March, which now seems a very long time ago. Now, at the time, Public Health England provided guidelines on PPE, and the guidelines were primarily geared towards what they called aerosol-generating procedures. We knew that vitreoretinal surgery, or we know that vitreoretinal surgery, involves patients operating very close to patients' nasopharynxes for sometimes half an hour to 45 minutes to an hour at a time. And so there's a real concern of working this close to patients who might be infected. Aerosol generating procedures are procedures that produce aerosols, and aerosols are small particles of less than 10 microns. And Public Health England had suggested that for such procedures, FFP3 masks be used. And FFP3 masks filter out 95% of particles. We wanted vitreoretinal surgeons to have the necessary protection. When doing vitreoretinal surgery, or at least have the option to wear it, to have this and be able to request their trust in their hospitals to provide them with it. Now, aerosol generating procedures are regarded as one of the definitions include high speed surgical devices. Vitreoretinal cutters, you know, cutting in excess of 7,000 cuts per minute, and phacoemulsification with, you know, in excess of 1.2 kilohertz. Are certainly high-speed surgical devices, and we therefore assumed or used this as an argument that our surgical devices were indeed aerosol-generating procedures, and as such, vitreoretinal surgeons should be afforded FFP3 masks whilst performing surgery. So that's what the guidelines were initially, and our guidelines also stipulated that we should that not just the surgeon but also the scrub nurse should equally be protected, because we felt that the scrub nurses are often follow the lead of the surgeon and often don't have a voice of their own, and so our guidelines suggest that they too be protected, because they too are in close proximity to patients' nasopharynx. Now, during the pandemic, we were in my unit just doing vitreoretinal surgery. And we were operating with FFP3 masks and goggles initially as well, as recommended. We also started putting secondary drapes over the microscope to act like a skirt to further reduce aerosol transmission. So the patient would have a mask on, they would have a drape on, and then they'd have a further drape around the microscope, and we would bring FFP3 masks.
That's really interesting. So Aman, thinking all the way back to earlier in the year when we were only doing emergency surgery and practically all routine work was cancelled, what surgery were you actually performing beyond retinal detachment repair? Were you still performing treatment for submacular hemorrhage, for example?
Absolutely. So good question. So it wasn't just, of course, retinal detachments. It was also ocular trauma, vitreous hemorrhages of unknown origin, and submacular hemorrhages were being treated with pneumatic displacement. That was the bulk of our work. As time's gone by, most vitreoretinal units have restarted more elective work. And we are now doing almost the full spectrum again, including macular holes, epiretinal membranes, you know, drop nucleuses now that cataract surgery has returned, and the full spectrum of VR surgery has now returned.
So with all the talk about phaco and vitrectomy being aerosol generating procedures, have you ever heard anybody arguing for the increased utilization of scleral buckling where possible?
No. So let's talk about the AGP again. So the AGP was a was really a vehicle for us to be able to recommend PPE. There's been some good work since our paper came out that's beginning to demonstrate that vitreoretinal surgery may not be an AGP. Now, in answer to your question, most buckling is done under general anaesthetic, which itself poses a further risk to the anaesthetist and staff. So certainly in my experience, we were not doing more buckles, and in fact, we're probably doing less buckles because of the length of the surgery and potentially the requirement for general anaesthetic.
Oh, of course, yes, that actually does make a lot of sense. So, Aman, right at the beginning of the pandemic, when VR surgeons were in the minority of ophthalmologists continuing to operate, what kind of PPE were you wearing? And how has that changed to today?
So, in the peak of the pandemic, my patients would wear a mask and they would have tape put on top of their mask. Because if you wear a mask, actually it redirects your breath upwards towards your eyes. So we taped their mask down. They would have the natural surgical drape. I then had I developed a drape to go around the microscope to act as a further drape over the patient. I myself would wear an FFP3 mask that I was fit tested for, and initially I was wearing goggles as well, and the same for the scrub nurse, FFP3 mask and goggles. How's that changed since then? I've taken the goggles off now, and I don't wear goggles when doing surgery, because it was becoming unfeasibly difficult to operate with them. The tape on the mask, the patient's mask, is still being used. We do have a bit more of a problem with fogging of the re-sight lens during surgery because of the patient's breath. So other than the goggles, my practice is very similar to how it was during the peak of the pandemic.
It's really interesting that you say that. And you know, one thing that I have noticed occasionally is that because of the use of the mask that I'm wearing during cataract surgery, I sometimes notice that the oculars on the microscope get fogged up. Do you think that we can use this justification to try and persuade our trusts to purchase head-up operating microscopes like the Alcon Ingenuity or the Artivo microscope from Zeiss?
I think that's a good question in terms of, you know, wearing goggles. So I've been wearing masks my whole life for surgery, and I've always put tape over the top of the mask, and that, just a tip for you, that stops the fogging. So if you wear a surgical mask, put a sticking tape over your nose, prevents the fogging. But but if you were to wear goggles to further reduce the risk of transmission, and that's just very difficult to use a microscope. So I think that's a good additional argument for a benefit for heads up surgery. Whether that will be compelling enough for trusts to invest in it, that's a different question.
So, Aman, you briefly mentioned before that there was some evidence to suggest that vitrectomy and phaco may not actually be aerosol generating. Could you elaborate a bit further on that and explain to the listeners a bit about the evidence which has been circulated in regards to this?
There's a paper that's coming out quite soon from Australia that investigated the aerosol transmission from patients and in vitro as well, in an artificial setup, using vitrectomy cutters, and demonstrated actually that no aerosol or no large molecules were produced. And so this was that's coming out very soon, and that's probably quite compelling. And I think there'll be more and more studies that demonstrate that the small particle production from the vitrectomy cutters is probably very little. And as you know, there's some suggestions that within phaco, although you can see spray, firstly, using maybe some viscoelastic on the surface of the eye may reduce that spray further. And actually, whether that spray represents patient's own aqueous or does it, by the time it's being used, it actually probably represents saline or viscoelastic. So whether these surgical devices actually produce aerosol is probably being demonstrated not to be the case, or we don't know for certain yet, but it's possibly not the case. And even if it is, we as yet don't know whether SARS-CoV-2 exists within intraocular fluid. And if it does, we still don't know the infectivity of it. So there's a lot of unknowns, and you've got to, you know, take your mind back to the peak of the pandemic when all these unknowns were leading to a lot of anxiety. But as time's gone by, some of that anxiety may have relaxed a little bit.
So the guidelines say that we should still be wearing FFP3 masks for vitreoretinal surgery. Do you think there'll be a time in the future where we can stop wearing FFP3 masks for surgery? And do you think that we'll go back to the way we were before at all?
The guidelines that were written in March, and actually we've reiterated them now for Beavers most recently, they're guidelines that FFP3 masks be worn. They're not diktats, they're not instructions, and they're not rules. So actually, there are many surgeons who already have stopped wearing FFP3 masks for vitreoretinal surgery. It's really up to an individual, their own assessment for risk. And the risk is from the patient's nasopharynx, with them lying on their back and their own aerosol, which is generated, drifting upwards as it's warm. And many surgeons now already don't wear FFP3 masks. So I think the time will come when people are comfortable and happy to do so, and that may already be the case.
Yes, that's very true. I've actually definitely seen that myself in practice. So Aman, the final point that I wanted to discuss with you is really about the future of ophthalmology. And how do you think that things will change for the future in our specialty, and specifically in VR? For example, the patients we see with epiretinal membrane for follow-up, do you think that we'll always need to see those patients or similar patients face-to-face in the clinic? Or do you think we can remotely manage them and just do imaging and do more telephone consultations or virtual consultations?
You know that this is absolutely topical. This is absolutely a really good question, and the future is in our hands now. As a clinical medicine is based on doctors seeing patients, examining them, and patients being reassured by that. That's been going on for centuries. However, in ophthalmology and in medicine generally, but certainly in ophthalmology, we are an image based specialty and an investigation based specialty. Virtual medicine has been around for a long time. Virtual clinics have been around for a long time, but we've never really adapted to them. We must now really take this on. Monitoring of diabetic retinopathy, so screening for diabetic retinopathy is one element of virtual medicine that's already been undertaken within ophthalmology. But we can do that for many more things. As you say, epiretinal membranes, but glaucoma, keratoconus, many parts of ophthalmology can be done remotely now. You could almost have patients go to a data center, which is not in a hospital, to collect all their data and then be reviewed remotely. We must really take this opportunity to develop virtual clinics, virtual self-monitoring at home for patients, and other adaptations to our practice that reduces patient footfall in hospitals or in eye clinics. We've got to do it, and there's many things that we can do, and we really must embrace this moment.
Well, Aman, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been really interesting. Despite everything that's happened, hopefully we will see some positive progression in our practice in the months and years ahead, especially with regards to digital health and technology.
I think that's already happening, and I hope it just continues to progress in that way.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.
Don't forget to register for the remotely supervised simulated surgery webinar hosted by John Ferris on the 4th of February. Places are still available and can be booked directly from the college website.